Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. For years, questions about Thomas Jefferson and his use of slaves have perplexed legions of Americans. How could the founding father, who once called slavery an abominable crime, manage to be a slaveholder his entire life and even extend slavery during his presidency? Historian Henry Winsick tackles this thorny knot in his book, Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves, and the results aren't pretty. Henry Winsick concludes that there are no excuses for the nation's third president, and that during his lifetime, Jefferson flipped from an all-out believer in emancipation to one who was able to justify it for the sake of another old-fashioned idea, financial profit. Henry Winsick is a past winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award and author of An Imperfect God, George Washington, His Slaves, and the Creation of America. He speaks in town tonight, and it's a pleasure to have him here. Henry, good morning.
Thanks, Steve. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, you are stripping the bark off of Thomas Jefferson in this book, and I'm just wondering, Henry, what kind of reaction are you getting?
So far, the reaction outside of where of Jefferson country has been very positive. I've gotten some rave reviews from newspaper reviewers and also from academics who don't have any connections to Charlottesville.
But inside Jefferson country, a little rougher.
Inside the orbit of Mr. Jefferson in Charlottesville, Virginia, things have been a little rough. I mean, they really don't want to hear this stuff. I mean, they've been keeping it under wraps for a long time. And it presents a portrait that they just don't like, and they're trying to discredit it.
Keeping it under wraps, you mean they suspected so much of this was true and just didn't want to confront it themselves, you think?
I cannot understand how they did not come across some of the what I regard as nasty stuff in Jefferson's financial records, you know, where he's saying that part of the profit of a plantation is, you know, the 4% increase every year, you know, in the birth of black babies.
Yeah.
I was stunned when I found that. And I looked through the whole Jeffersonian literature, all the recent and all the scholarship on slavery and Jefferson, and nobody had ever cited that document. And I have to believe that they had seen it. And there were other things also that they had to know about, and they either just closed their eyes to them or they just refused to connect the dots.
Henry, you were stunned by the 4% profit thing. Exactly why?
Because it was so cold, so callous, so precise.
It's making money off of other human beings.
It's making money off of the birth of children. Now, some of the Jeffersonians are saying, hey, we've always known that slaveholders considered black people to be capital assets. Well, yes, we have known that. But we've never seen such a cold, callous, heartless calculation. From Thomas Jefferson. And as I said, I was stunned when I found that, and equally stunned to see that nobody had ever commented upon it.
Hmm. You know, I'm just wondering, as you mentioned, there is a sense of ambivalence in this country about this issue of Jefferson and his slaves. And, you know, a lot of folks have written all of this off with this very simple idea. I don't mean that critically at all, that Jefferson was a man of his times and that men back then owned slaves. And that's just the way the world worked back then. But you don't think that's enough.
Well, actually, I agree with that. I agree that Jefferson was a man of his times, and I think we should take that a little farther. I think Jefferson illuminates his times. When he is typical of many of the aspects of slaveholders and slavery, and when we look at him carefully, we can begin to understand things that seemed paradoxical or contradictory before. We begin to get a sense of how is it that slavery survived the revolution when we fought the revolution for universal human rights. How is it that when, scholars have said, well, slavery was dying out in the 1790s, that somehow it flourished and then expanded? How did that happen? And by looking at Jefferson, we can get answers to some of these questions.
Hmm. You know, your basic argument is that Jefferson should have known better. In fact, he did know better, and yet he walked away from this idea of emancipating his own slaves. Why?
Well, you know what? Let me go back to one of your premises. I try not to lecture Thomas Jefferson about what he should have done or should have known. I don't believe in going back into the past and saying, Tom, you should do this or should do that. I try to put him in his own context and look at him according to the standards of other people of his own time And I look at him particularly through the lens of people like Lafayette and Thomas Paine.
And George Washington.
George Washington. But specifically Lafayette and Thomas Paine and other people came to Jefferson personally.
And said, told him.
"You, Mr. Jefferson, you are the embodiment of all of our ideals. If you actually believe what you wrote, you have to begin freeing your slaves."
When did they do that? When did Lafayette go to Jefferson and say those words to him?
Well, he did it at the very end of – almost at the end of Jefferson's life when Lafayette visited in 1824 and visited Monticello in Virginia in 1824. But earlier he had written to Jefferson about that. And a number of people did. That's one of the things that surprised me in the research is to see how many people had approached Jefferson and said, "Give us a plan. Come forward. Be the leader." Or had given him specific plans about how to free the slaves. And he always, after a certain period, he deflected them. So, as you mentioned earlier, in his younger days, he was a fiery emancipationist. He was a true radical. And if he had gotten his way in the 1760s and 1780s, our history might very well have been different.
And so he changes.
Yes, he does.
He transforms over the years, Henry. Why? What did you find out in your research that begins to explain what his thinking, how his thinking changed over the years?
I think that something shocked him during the Revolution, and that was the number of slaves who ran away to seek freedom with the British Army, because the British offered freedom to anyone, male, female, old, young, children who could reach their ranks. And so thousands of Virginia slaves and thousands of slaves all across the South ran to the British. Jefferson regarded this as a terrible act of disloyalty to him personally, because some of his slaves ran off, and to the emerging country. But he greatly exaggerated the number of these slaves who ran off to the British, and he completely ignored the greater number of slaves who fought for the Patriot cause in George Washington's army and in other units. He insisted later on that anyone who was a slave could never have a love of this country. And there are particular instances that I bring out in the book where there were a couple of slaves on his plantation who risked their lives for him, mm-hmm. to save him and his property from the British. And it really didn't make a very deep impression on him. You would think that it would have altered his views about the universal disloyalty of black people, but it didn't.
Ah, this is so interesting. I want to go back to something you said just a couple of minutes ago where you were talking about others who urged Jefferson over the years to give up his slaves and set an example. In fact, others went before him and did set an example. I'm thinking of the founder of this country who did something, made a different set of choices than Thomas Jefferson did.
Right, he did. My previous book was about George Washington, and it's called An Imperfect God. And I began that book because, as I began this one, out of a sense of puzzlement. I mean, but in a different kind of puzzlement. I was thinking, how is it that George Washington freed his slaves? Because, you know, Jefferson didn't, and so many other people of the time didn't. What was it specifically that made him do it? And the usual answer is that he decided at the end of his life when he was writing his will that he was going to free his slaves, possibly because he simply owned too many and didn't want to saddle his heirs with them. But what I found is that he had been trying to free his slaves for about 10 years and had been trying to find the financial backing. He had been trying to sell land to finance the emancipation of his slaves and failed to find buyers. And then he approached his wife's family, because his wife Martha had inherited – or her family had inherited most of the slaves that lived at Mount Vernon. So he went to one of his in-laws and said, "Look, I want to free all the slaves at Mount Vernon, not just my own, but the ones that you people own. Let's set them free and then hire them right back as sharecroppers." Mm-hmm. Now, sharecropping was not new. Sharecropping had been in Virginia for decades. Well, Martha's relatives were not interested. They wanted to keep the asset value of the slaves. And the interesting thing is that George Washington was thwarted because he ran into people like Thomas Jefferson, you know, who thought in those terms.
Henry Winsick is our guest. His new book, Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves, the results, all of this, not very pretty. He's the man who electrified the world with his very bold assertion that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. He himself was a slaveholder throughout his lifetime. That's our topic today. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Up to date at kcur.org is our email address. You can also reach us on KCUR's Facebook page and on Twitter at KCUR Up to Date. You know, as you're talking, Henry, I'm just sitting here wondering how different the world would have been if Jefferson had followed the ideas that George Washington had and had indeed freed his slaves back early on. What difference, you can only begin to theorize what vast changes that could have resulted in American society, much less a civil war maybe not happening.
Right, right. There are a couple of examples that I can point to in Jefferson's political record about this. I mean, we really don't grasp how deeply he was dedicated to freeing the slaves in the Revolutionary era. 2 years before he wrote the Declaration of Independence, he wrote another document in which he called for the enfranchisement of the slaves that we have. And what enfranchisement means is to give people the rights of citizenship. What he said was that if only we can stop the slave trade, if only we can stop the influx of new slaves, we can then – this country can then absorb the people we – the black people we have here and make them citizens. That idea that he floated in 1774 didn't get any traction. 10 years later, when he was in the Continental Congress, he was writing the language for the Ordinance of 1784 that would govern the new territories in the United States. And he wrote language that said, after 1800, there will be no slavery in any new territory of the United States. Essentially, he drew a red line around the map and said, beyond this, no slavery. And that territory would have included Alabama and Mississippi.
And the whole Louisiana Purchase, right?
Well, yes, but that was – yes, exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. that was not even contemplated in 1784.
Right.
But imagine Alabama and Mississippi as free states. That is what Jefferson wanted. His language was defeated by one vote when one delegate to the Congress was sick and couldn't show up to vote. And Jefferson himself said that the fate of millions unborn hung on the voice of one man who was tragically absent. So that shows you how far Jefferson was willing to go, not only to limit slavery, but to put it on the road to extinction.
Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to Martin from Kansas City, Missouri. Martin, you're on with Henry Winsick. Good morning.
Morning. Thank you. Just a comment. I was thinking I've been reading David McCullough's great biography of John Adams and
yes.
the descriptions of Jefferson contained therein. And I was thinking another of the reason that Jefferson held on to his slaves was financial in the sense that he was pretty much known as pretty extravagant. He was a fairly high-maintenance individual who pretty profligate with his money. And so it would have been more difficult just from a purely financial perspective for him to give up his slaves.
What a great point, Martin. Thomas Jefferson was a huge spender, right?
Oh, beyond belief. I mean, put aside, you know, the expensive wines and the books and the instruments, the musical instruments for his family. I think that the whole issue of Jefferson's debt has been greatly exaggerated. He complained about it all the time, but he really did have it under control. I had a number of discussions about this with another expert from the Jefferson Library who studied Jefferson's finances very carefully, and he and I agreed that Jefferson was a financial genius. He was always finding new sources of credit, always refinancing. Hmm. He kept his debts under control. And you have to remember, he built Monticello twice. And after he returned from France, he decided he was going to rebuild what he had done before in the French style. So he took down what he did before and rebuilt Monticello. Then he built another mansion outside of Lynchburg, Virginia, called Poplar Forest. Then he invested some $30,000 in a mill and canal project at the foot of Monticello Mountain. Debt never stopped Jefferson from doing anything that he wanted to do. The problem arose near the end of his life in 1820 when he foolishly co-signed a promissory note for a relative that committed him. A relative came to him and said, look, I need your signature on a $20,000 note. And Jefferson said, fine. 6 months later, the relative went bankrupt.
Mm.
And then things really got bad.
Well, to what extent is Martin raising a point here that Thomas Jefferson's spending caused him to do what he did, change his thinking when it came to slavery?
That's a good point. I mean, Jefferson's change of mind about the slaves was a process that took place over a number of years, mainly in the 1780s. One thing is he rather strangely developed his racial views that blacks and whites could never live together under the same free government, and that black blood and white blood could never mingle. Now, when he married his wife, Martha, she brought with her the Hemings family, and six of those were her half-siblings. So this mingling of the blood had already taken
Explain
place.
Explain that, because it was Martha's father, right? What happened there?
It was Martha Jefferson's father, John Wales, owned an enslaved woman named Betty Hemings. And after John Wales' third wife died, he began a relationship with Betty Hemings that produced six children. Hmm. So he was and one of them was Sally Hemings. So when Martha got married to Thomas, she brought with her the slaves that she inherited from her father, and among them were her half siblings. So this mixing that Jefferson claimed to find abhorrent had already taken place, and for his entire life, he made up his household staff of mixed race people, some of whom, according to visitors, were as white as anyone could be. And a number of whom, not just Sally Hemings' children, but the children of another woman, very closely resembled Thomas Jefferson.
Hmm. And we should point out Martha Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson's wife, died early, relatively speaking, in his life, and he remained single the rest of his life.
That's right. Yes, he never married again.
Yeah. Well, give us a little tour, Henry, just over the radio here, of Monticello and how the slaves were incorporated into that life and what they did at Monticello. Outline it for us a little bit.
Sure. Monticello is both a mansion and a mountain. Jefferson was born in 1743 at the foot of Monticello Mountain at his father's plantation called Shadwell. And his father owned Monticello, and when his father died, Jefferson inherited Monticello Mountain and decided that he was going to build his mansion there. So he built his mansion at the top of the mountain. Right below the mansion, he built a row of cabins and workshops, which is called Mulberry Row. And that is where the household servants and the top artisans lived and worked. There was a dairy, a nail factory, a textile factory, and other operations that supported the plantation and also brought in extra income. But farther down the mountain and at other locations around Monticello, there were other farms where the people worked, as Jefferson put it, in the ground. That's where the farming took place, first the tobacco planting and later wheat. And the enslaved community at Monticello was very segmented and very hierarchical. The people who lived on Mulberry Row were, by and large, Jefferson's black relatives. They were all related to him in one way or another by blood through his wife or by marriage. And the people farther down the mountain who did the harder work tended not to be related to him.
Yet he was the master of all.
Of all of them, right. And then he had other outlying plantations, the best known of which is at Poplar Forest, which was about 70 miles away in Lynchburg.
Tell us how many slaves did he have at the height of his life? How big did the population reach?
I think that the most that he owned at any one time, and the number may be a little bit off, but it's 130 to 140. In his lifetime, he owned over 600 slaves, which is a large number.
he would oversee this staff sometimes walking on a walkway behind his house as he looked down upon at least part of his grounds. Describe that to us.
Well, he had a terrace that was outside of his suite of rooms, which included a bedroom and his study. And every morning at first light, he would go out onto this terrace. And the funny thing is the terrace was right on top of the kitchen. So he would smell his coffee being brewed. He would smell hot chocolate being brewed. He would smell the biscuits baking. And he would hear the sounds of the kitchen going on underneath him. And if he stood in a certain spot, he could look down on Mulberry Row and see what kind of activities were going on. Another interesting thing, though, is that, later in his life, every evening, he would go out into Mulberry Row and spend some time with his mechanics to see what the cabinet makers and the blacksmiths were doing.
And he just enjoyed getting around a little bit, it sounds like.
Well, you know, we have a very interesting memoir that was an interview that was given by his blacksmith, Isaac Granger, also known as Isaac Jefferson, in the 1840s. And it contains a lot of vignettes about Jefferson, and we can see that Jefferson really got along well with Isaac when he was a young man, and that Jefferson brought Isaac into his own workshop where he made little trinkets out of metal. I mean, he made locks and keys and other things that he needed around the house. And Isaac was very impressed with him, and he records little snippets of conversation. Obviously, these two had an affinity for each other.
But this notion, though, of the benevolent dictator, the benevolent master here, though, you also take a whack at that pretty clearly in this book. Things may not have been at least how they've been portrayed over the decades here.
I think that's true. I mean, I think that if you keep a rigid focus on the way the people of Mulberry Row and the household were treated, you can say, oh, he was a rational and humane master who treated people benevolently. But the people who lived at the top of the mountain were better housed, better fed, better clothed. They had better, more interesting work to do than the people farther down. And the other thing is that Jefferson had many ways of distancing himself from the harshness of life on the plantation. He gave himself deniability, and a lot of scholars today read what he said, his kind of self-exonerating statements, how I love industry and abhor violence, and take that to be a reflection of the actuality. When you look at the records of the time, Jefferson's neighbors called one of his overseers a terror. One of his relatives said, I fear the poor Negroes fare hard. And another relative denounced the whole Southern system as a hideous monster.
And some of that violence came to the fore, Henry, when it came to the nail factory. What happened with the nail factory?
Well, this story is something that sort of unsettled the historians at Monticello because there was a letter that was written in 1801 from Jefferson's son-in-law, Colonel Randolph, to Jefferson, who was then president. And saying, or he was about to be inaugurated, and saying that the small ones, the children, are being whipped in the nail factory to get them to work. And Jefferson had no response to this. He did not. I checked the letters from the next several months, all the correspondence between those two men. And Jefferson never wrote back to him saying, this has got to stop. I won't tolerate this. Because Jefferson that winter had said, we need to keep up productivity, and the small ones especially need to be kept engaged. The interesting thing is that when that letter was first published in 1953 by a UVA scholar, he deleted the line about the children being whipped. He just did not want us to know.
Really?
Yeah.
Just took it out.
And when you read that letter in the 1953 publication, you will see at the end of it that Colonel Randolph says, and nobody is being whipped, dot, dot, dot. There's nothing else there. But when you look at the new transcription that didn't come out until, I believe, 2005, it says nobody is being whipped except the small ones, which completely reverses the meaning of the letter.
Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Let's grab a call or two before a break here. Joe from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Yes, very interesting subject, and I wonder how Jefferson was able to square slavery, the owning of slaves, and actually fathering children by a slave woman with his religion.
Hmm.
That's a good question.
Good question, Joe. Thank you.
Jefferson's religious beliefs are a mystery to me, and I think that they are the subject of a lot of debate. I mean, some people say that he was all but an atheist. I mean, when he prepared an edition of the New Testament in which he razored out all references to the divinity of Jesus Christ, but kept Christ's statements because he thought that Jesus was the greatest moral philosopher who ever lived. Occasionally, though, he spoke of the divine providence, and he said that divine providence expressed its satisfaction with human affairs by dispensing prosperity. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned this in one of his presidential addresses, and he said that our prosperity is evidence that divine providence approves what we're doing.
Now, let's take a break. When we come back, I'll grab a phone call from David. So, David, if you would please just hang on for a couple more minutes. We'll talk a little bit more about this idea of Jefferson overseeing his own children. And I should point out that Henry will be speaking tonight about his new book, Master of the Mountain, at 6:30 tonight at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. This is the branch on the Country Club Plaza. More information, kclibrary.org. This is all part of the library's Hail to the Chief series. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star. And you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation with veterinarian Dr. Wayne Hunhausen, you can find it in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, we'll talk about nuclear disarmament with a former mayor of Hiroshima, Japan, and Harry Truman's grandson. He'll be here as well, Clifton Truman Daniel. This hour, we're visiting with Henry Winsek. He's the author of a new book, Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves. He's stripping the bark off so much of what we know about Jefferson when it comes to the whole issue of slavery. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. David from Kansas City, Missouri. Thanks for holding on, David.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you began to approach this a little bit, but I wanted to ask more directly. What is the opinion about the allegation that Jefferson had children with his slave, Sally Hemings? There were several curious features of that. Some of her children resembled him, but also that he had left orders for the emancipation of her children alone among his several slaves. And as I understand, in 1998, a DNA investigation was done, and several conclude that this seems to confirm more than dismiss the allegation. So I wanted to ask about that.
David, thank you for the good call. Appreciate it.
Sure. That's one of the things that I was interested in looking into myself, because there were some confusing things about that and some loose ends. I was taken aback by something that one of the slaves said. It was his slave Isaac, who said that Randolph Jefferson, Jefferson's brother, liked to get drunk and frolic and dance in the slave quarter. And so to me, this held open the possibility that Randolph could have been the father of the Hemings children. And a number of people at Monticello were not happy that I was actually looking into this. I mean, one professor from UVA said, "I hear you've gone over to the dark side." I try to make it my habit to do as much primary research work as possible. And I took a very careful look at Isaac's memoir. And I found an earlier edition of it in the type, and this the book was designed in a different way. And when you see the original design, you understand that Isaac was talking about Randolph frolicking in a slave quarter somewhere else, not at Monticello. He was talking about Randolph frolicking among his own slaves. So the major sticking point that had been bothering me disappeared. I think that Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, very likely was the father of Sally Hemings' children. I think I arrived at this by a process of elimination. I just don't see anybody else.
Is there any doubt about that at this point, given the DNA evidence, or is there still some doubt?
Well, you know, the DNA evidence pointed towards some male Jefferson, not necessarily Thomas. And then we had a lot of – we had a good amount of historical evidence that pointed towards Thomas. One of my problems is perhaps as a writer and a researcher is that I tend to be a little bit too skeptical of what people ahead of me have said. So I just decided to re-examine the whole thing. And my skepticism grew, but then it went away.
You yourself believe that Jefferson is, in fact, the father of Sally Hemings' children.
Yes, I do. I do believe that Jefferson was the father.
And how many children are we talking about?
Well, she gave birth, I believe, to 6 children, only 4 of whom survived to adulthood. He allowed the 2 oldest children, Beverly and Harriet, to leave Monticello in 1822. He wrote down in his farm ledger that they were fugitives, that they ran away. But his manager said that he gave money to daughter Harriet to take a stage north. And then when Jefferson died, he freed the youngest 2 children, Madison and Eston Hemings, and allowed them to and petitioned the Virginia legislature to allow them to remain in the state, because in 1806, Virginia had passed a law that freed slaves had to be exiled.
But yet his own children were, in a very real sense, slaves to Thomas Jefferson for many, many years.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
What did he say about that?
Jefferson never said anything about it.
That's a remarkable thing.
This is one of the things that really threw me off. It's because there is no evidence in his records of any special treatment or affection for Sally Hemings or for her children. Their children worked at sort of mid-level jobs at Monticello. They did not have – I mean, they were taken care of in a way. I mean, they lived rather comfortably. But they didn't have high-ranking jobs, and there is no reference to any sign of affection. And Jefferson's son, Madison, later in 1873, said that he was not in the habit of showing us any fatherly affection. Madison left what I see as a very bleak account of his life at Monticello.
What do you make of this? I mean, this is just such a remarkable story. What do you make of the fact that Jefferson, in a sense, was master to his own children who were kept as slaves? And what do you make of Jefferson today, given all the time you spent on this, Henry?
My feelings about Jefferson himself are still settling down. I have been accused in print of loathing Jefferson, and that is absolutely untrue. That's wrong. But you know, the funny thing about our feelings towards Jefferson, one of the most critical books ever written about him came out, I think 20 years ago, written by an Irishman, Conor Cruise O'Brien, called The Long Affair, in which he says that, you know, Jefferson founded racism in the country and that he was the forefather of terrorism and that Americans should throw him out of their pantheon of founders and heroes. Well, only a foreigner would think that way. Mm-hmm. We can't get rid of him because he's our father. He's part of our identity. He's part of who we are. So we have to come to terms with him somehow.
But boy, that's tough. I mean, in the wake of your book, boy, that's tough.
It is. It's very hard. But
I mean, this icon is something else entirely, again, you know, viewed through today's standards.
Well,
but still, you just almost can't square the knot.
Well, you know what? I think that it shows us how powerfully corrupting slavery was. And it shows us – I mean, it's another example of the old axiom that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I remember back in 92, there was a conference in Charlottesville about Jefferson. And this is, you know, well before DNA, at the time when nobody except a few African Americans believed that Jefferson was the father of the Hemings children. A black man got up at UVA and said, "What about the question of Jefferson being the father of these children?" And one of the professors on the dais said that it was absolutely impossible because Jefferson would never, ever hold his own children in slavery. That struck him as an abomination. And Julian Bond was there, and he stood up and said something that I've never forgotten. He said Jefferson had already held other people in slavery. From there, it was only a short step to enslaving his own children. And he encapsulated something very powerful and very disturbing, and about how corruption works. If you will allow yourself to go so far, then maybe you'll go just a little bit farther and hold your own children in slavery. And that's what Jefferson did.
But you say, Henry, you don't loathe Thomas Jefferson by any means. So all of this, how do you regard him then? How do you take this in the context of the man who wrote all men are, you know, all these truths are said to be self-evident, that all men are created equal? How do you get there?
That's a tough question, Steve. I really had a lot of trouble writing this book because of my admiration for Jefferson, for the Declaration, of course, for his establishment of more democratic forms of government, and also for the Statute of Virginia for religious freedom, which is, you know, established rights that we're still fighting over today. And I always believed that he was stuck with slavery and that he would have gotten rid of it if he could. And then I found that was not true. And I'm still coming to grips with it. I really don't know what to say.
Well, Julian Bond's comments, what an insightful thing to hear at this point in our conversation.
Yeah.
Back to some phone calls. Ian from Kansas City, Missouri. Ian, good morning. You're on with Henry Winsek.
Thank you for all the great information, Vision, and about why he might have changed his opinion from being against slavery to being for it. But my question is on the other end of the spectrum. What initially made him hate slavery so much? If there's any story there.
That's a very good question. I think he hated it on a number of grounds. One was its terrible physical cruelty. When he wrote his book, Notes on the State of Virginia, in the mid-1780s, he called slavery unremitting despotism, and he describes a scene in which a white child, sees his slave-owning parent, he doesn't say if it's mother or father, beating a slave, or as he says, giving loose to the worst of his passions. And he said this is how children absorbed and learned how to be cruel themselves. He was very eloquent on that ugly side of slavery. The other thing is that he was an absolutist in his beliefs in human rights.
Mm-hmm.
He believed that all men are created equal and that those inalienable rights extended to black people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only later that he changed. And I think that part of it had to do with a debt that began to trouble him. And the funny thing is he began to blame the slaves for his being in debt.
Yeah.
And the other thing is he began to exaggerate the disloyalty of slaves during the Revolution, which I talked about before.
You know, Henry, you mentioned you've had your critics in this book about this book. One of them was an article in Slate that pointed out there were, they say, factual errors here. One of them they point to was this 4% figure about the profit that Thomas Jefferson would make from his slaves. Slate said basically that Jefferson was talking about slavery all across the country when he wrote that and not on his own estate.
All in Virginia is what they
said. All Virginia, okay. Yeah. What about that?
Well, if that's true, it makes it worse.
Okay.
I don't see it that way. And they also they pulled up a letter that Jefferson wrote a year later, describing in which Jefferson describes how he came by his numbers. And he says quite clearly, I relied on my own recollections. So he's obviously talking about Monticello. At any rate, the objection that the author of that is Annette Gordon-Reed, the objection that she raises is meaningless because, okay, he wasn't talking about Monticello. Let's agree for the sake of argument he's talking about all of Virginia. That does make it worse because then he's saying this increase in the black population is the engine of the economy for all of Virginia.
Hmm. Back to some phone calls here. Margaret from Kansas City, Missouri. Margaret, you're on the program. Good morning. You there, Margaret? Okay. You've also said that he's been characterized as progressive in some cases. And I wanted to go back to what you said a few minutes ago about the violence in terms of his own slaves. And there was this phrase you used that really struck me, which was calibrated violence. The Monticello machine operated on calibrated violence. What did you mean by that?
Jefferson did not like cruelty. He did not like to have slaves punished. But he knew that it was necessary because people don't like being slaves. And he told his overseer, some people require a vigor of discipline to get them to do reasonable work.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was always often using expressions like that. And he gave a lot of instructions to his son-in-law, or Colonel Randolph, who was the overseer of the overseers, to get him to extract the maximum productivity from the slave force with the least possible violence, but violence was required. He knew that.
Let me try one more phone call here. John from Lawrence. John, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Howdy.
Hi.
The one thing that I haven't really seen commented on regarding Sally Hemings and the children there is how people thought of mistresses and how people thought of bastard children at the time.
Hmm.
And it seems to me that, in general, mistresses generally got a very, very poor treatment from even very respectable people. And bastard children frequently had a really pretty awful life. Hmm. And so when you add in the context of slavery and whatnot, it actually doesn't seem that it seems extreme by our standards,
right?
But for the time, it seems like that was his treatment was actually may have been somewhat average for what you would expect.
Interesting thoughts. Yeah,
it's hard to make generalizations about this because every family is different. Every father and every mistress is different. And so I just know one of Jefferson's neighbors, or not a neighbor, but his friend John Hartwell Cock, who was one of the co-founders of UVA with him, referred to the damnable practice of slaveholders in Virginia, taking slave mistresses. And he said it was very widespread, and people have Mr. Jefferson's example to get them off the hook. One thing, Madison Hemings said a number of things that are fascinating, but one leapt out at me. He said that one thing that set him and his siblings apart from the other slaves is that they were free of the dread of knowing that they'd be slaves their whole lives long.
Hmm.
They knew that one day they would be free, and which on the one hand it reflects well on Jefferson that he kept his promise to them, but on the other, it tells us that everybody else lived in dread.
Henry, I enjoyed having you. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it.
That's Henry Winsek. His new book, Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves. Again, he speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Plaza Branch. More information, kclibrary.org.